Hey, you.
It is good. Thanks, Saint.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are in the world, and a big hello to our listeners on Radio Sega. Good afternoon if you're listening on Winterfest, and this is a special episode returning once again for Radio Sega's Winterfest, so sit back, relax, for some good old Sega chat. And as always, I'm joined by the Akira Yuki to my Sonic the Hedgehog. It's James the Sega Holic. How you doing, mate?
I am back and fully voiced, full of energy, mate. Delighted to be forming part of Winterfest once again, although this time as an official part of the Radio Sega team, not as a guest, so to speak, but as part of the official lineup. So I hope you all enjoy what we've got in store for you with this very special episode. We've been away for a wee while, obviously a bit of a hiatus as Radio Sega does prepare for Winterfest. We've kind of dug into the archives a wee bit, but we'll be back in the new year with plenty of new content, so we haven't gone anywhere. But I'm doing great, mate. How's yourself?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Things have been a little bit crazy with work and just usual life. So as always, I'm just excited to be here on a chat with you, mate, because yeah, even before we hit the record button, we were having a few laughs, and just brings a smile to my face, and much needed. And I hope that some of that happiness transfers over to our listeners as we say, it's a Winterfest episode, so we're going to make it a special one, and we're going to talk about Raised by Sega, which is it's a phrase that I've grown to absolutely adore in the last few months or so. But what do you think, James? What's the best way to say what is Raised by Sega?
I think, again, the way Sega are today and the way they have been since the kind of demise of the Dreamcast, it's very much one of those kind of timestamp moments. I think if you're raised, is it even possible to be raised by Sega now? Probably not.
It
would be very difficult. So, yeah, I think it's just a case of combining everything just about those kind of magical days in the 80s and 90s, combining those arcade memories and hoping to see those games at home, these magical, innovative systems that just every month seemed to be something new, something bold, something colourful. You know, whether it was an arcade conversion, an original title, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful time as Sega continued to innovate and lead the way, as I said, at home and in the arcade. And then, of course, being the kids that we were, when Sega were at their absolute peak, obviously they formed many a part of our most memorable Christmases and indeed birthdays. So Sega were pretty much part of everyday life growing up, but they also had an influence and an impact directly on, you know, special life events and occasions as we went from being boys to men, and here we are as grumpy old men, grumpy old Sega bees. Need to watch what I say language-wise if it's on Winterfest, but I think you can certainly say the fact that you and I, you know, I'm 42, you're not far behind me, that we're sitting here on a Sega radio internet station, on an annual Sega, you know, podcasting event, talking about Sega still. I think that says all you need to know, that we have most definitely been raised by Sega, and raised the right way, mate.
Absolutely. If you were raised by Sega, I don't think you can imagine being raised any other way, because Sega's games always had such a distinct look and feel. And I think I first heard the phrase uttered by Chris McFeely on the Sonic the Comic podcast. He was talking about picking up the Sega Mega Drive Mini. And that's when he said that, you know, after being raised by Sega, you know, he'd picked up this console and all of a sudden he was invigorated and he was enjoying that mini console of emulating, you know, 20 to 30 year old games more than many games in the recent years. And I think that's because Sega was so distinctive. They really had that look and feel that they absolutely nailed. And if you fell in love with that sort of that arcade style gameplay and that approach, and that there's something about Sega that there's just so daring and inventive and adventurous, snapshots of just perfection distilled in gameplay form. And I think once you became accommodated, then it was very difficult to move over to anything else. I mean, I think you've got people that are raised by, you know, especially in the younger generation now, because obviously Sega haven't made a console in over 20 years. But you've got people that are raised by other platforms. And I think you can probably pigeonhole people, you know, Nintendo gamers like their Mario, the Zeldas and stuff. Xbox gamers tend to like their, you know, mostly online games or and you've got PlayStation gamers that like their cinematic experiences. But I was watching a Sega Lord X video this week in which he was reviewing Splatterhouse 2. And he was saying it's not the best game in the world, but I think his words were, if you like a game where you don't have to sit through 5 minutes of cutscenes and goddamn tutorials just to get the damn thing playing, this game's for you. And mate, he's knocked it on the head there, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of pigeonholing you're talking about, I mean, I know when it comes to Xbox, you know, the kind of, you know, players on Xbox, and you and I are primarily also Xbox gamers, although we have obviously owned PlayStations and various Nintendo consoles through the years, but as well as the online aspect, you've got the kind of the trifecta of obviously Halo, Gears and Forza, you know, so you know, having those kind of tent poles on there as well, people tend to be, if you're on Xbox, you play those, and else you're online with a combination of those games. And as you said, you know, your Nintendo guys, they've kind of been the same. And I think probably Nintendo are the only ones, I think, that are probably ever going to come close to having that kind of impact. I mean, I would mm-hmm. say if there was the Nintendo Guys podcast out there, then, you know,
in an alternate dimension.
Jesus, imagine that. Maybe it's a good idea that I go to that Atari ST after all. But no, it's a case that they've obviously, you know, gone through from 80s all the way through, and obviously they're still going, and I'm not at all bitter about that, the fact that they're still going in terms of hardware. But yeah, they can kind of hold a claim that their fans most definitely have been raised by Nintendo as well. It definitely is that kind of pigeonhole where you can certainly, you know, timestamp on certain formats, and you can put certain gamers into them, but nothing quite had that, you know, that kind of arcade. You know, that arcade in the home was always what Sega was trying to do, always what Sega was, you know, aiming for. Even you look back at what Tom Kalinske was saying, you know, in Console Wars, when he first seen the 16-bit technology, and it was like nothing he'd ever seen before, and it was bringing the arcade home, even as much as he looked at Altered Beast and he thought it was a bit too demonic. But in terms of the technology and what it was trying to do, I just think, yeah, it was just, you can definitely kind of have those pigeonholes, as you say, but I don't think anybody has quite had the impact or the kind of maybe art style and direction that Sega had.
Yeah, and I think if I could sum up Sega in one word during the years that I was being raised by Sega, it would be adventurous, because everything just felt so daring. I feel like the whole time they were punching above their weight. I mean, they started out, you know, the Master System was never caught the NES, but they were still trying to catch Nintendo, and they managed to catch and then surpass them with the Sega Mega Drive and Sega Genesis. And they were determined to be on top of the game, innovate in every way, you know, early adopters of CD-based hardware, early adopters of online gaming. I mean, people talking about online gaming site with the Dreamcast, you know, we've had conversations about the Xbox documentary this week, but
yes,
even before the Dreamcast, the Mega Drive had an online modem adapter. The mm-hmm. Sega Saturn, when we had, was it Tom Morrell that said that the plan was at some point to get a modem built into the Sega Saturn?
When I'm that sure was it was in Al. Anyway. Al said that, yeah. I'm sure it was Al said that. It might have been Tom. We talked to all these Sega legends, you know, it's hard to keep up, mate.
Indeed. You look at stuff like the Afterburner, you know, the gyroscopic cabinet they had. You look at that and you think, you've got to be some sort of madman. Who gave that the seal of approval? Yep, go and build this giant hydraulic nightmare.
Thing is, mate, right, before that gets to the public, right, that has to get safety tested. Yeah. I'm just trying to imagine some poor bugger sitting on this. It's not turning off, man.
Oh, but that whole cabinet, mate. I mean, how much must that have cost? I mean, you got to stick your crash test dummies in there. It's just what I love about Sega, right there. You know, just daring to just do something just so mad, and it's iconic, that cabinet. And I've only been in one once, and it was as a kid, and I thought it was absolutely amazing. But you couldn't imagine anything like that being built these days. No one would have the balls to go out there and build something that spins you around like that, dude.
No chance. Again, it's a shame. Obviously, you don't really get much in terms of innovation in the arcade anymore, especially anything that comes over to the West. But nobody's making that now. You know, let's get a giant sphere, stick a game inside it, put a chair and some controls in there, and spin you around in a circle like a nutcase. It's like it's like the gaming version of being stuck in a washing machine.
Oh,
it's just what your denim see whenever it looks back at you.
I can't see.
But as I say, the balls to do it, and then it got so much, you know. That's such a good response, and you see it in, it's iconic, that cabinet. You see it in like Terminator 2 and stuff, and it's just wonderful. But they were just so adventurous. I mean, the Sega Channel was Game Pass 20 years before the fact. It's just amazing. But I think that Sega logo, the first time I actually became kind of aware of it, I think it's just something about it struck a chord with me. And I was thinking about it the other day, mate. I mean, I do have an affinity towards white and blue because of my football team. And I was thinking, I don't know if it was probably the same for you subconsciously.
Well, they don't get any red in there, but they're saying again, Sonic's got red shoes. So, I mean, there you go. Sonic is unofficially a Rangers mascot. There you go. Thanks very much. Red, white and blue. Can't he grumble. Yeah. It's just... I can't remember when the first time we seen that lovely blue logo, which, by the way, Jason Madison actually told me something. I didn't know this was the case. He told me, and you might be able to verify this might be something you already knew, that the Sega logo in Japan is a slightly bluer tint of blue than the Western Sega logo.
Yeah, I've seen that before.
Didn't know that.
It's very, very, very strange that someone would change the blue tint. But it's almost like switching the Dreamcast world from orange to red. It's just one of those odd things. But I think we can both agree. I think being raised by Sega, for me, it was, you know, I think we both came from the personal computers. I was or home computers as they were called. I started out on a Commodore 64. You started out on a ZX Spectrum. So it's not even a case that Sega was our first way of playing games or experiencing games in the home. We both experienced, we both had other flings before we met the love of our life.
We got about, mate.
Yeah, we did. You got to be a bit promiscuous in your early days, didn't you?
The video game equivalent of Tinder. I've no matched. Swipe along.
What's that? Amstrad CPC, swipe along. Nintendo, swipe along.
Oh, Sega, you have a match.
Oh, but I suppose, obviously, my first experience was with the Commodore 64, and yours, obviously, Spectrum and then ST. But do you remember what the first Sega game was that you played? The first game, when it comes to mine, I didn't even know that mine was a Sega game. It hadn't logged, but I share my memories and stuff. But if you tell us what your first Sega game was, when were you first introduced by the company we love?
Well, that would be part of... I mean, I hate giving the ST props, man. And like, all the guys in the Discord, like Resident and 20 and Viper will be sitting going, he's going to mention this Atari ST again. Honestly, the Atari ST came with us. I've mentioned it before. It was like a big LP style, like sleeve, big stupid cardboard book, and you opened it up and there was like all these wee kind of plastic angled disc holders, and there was a single game in each, so there was no multi-disc games. It was just every one was like a game that could fit on one disc, and it was all like kind of arcade games. And I remember Afterburner Space Harrier and Hang On were in there. And again, at the time, I didn't know they were Sega games, you know, because I'm completely oblivious to all this kind of stuff at that age. And the first one I tried was Afterburner. So Afterburner holds the kind of the privilege of being my first played Sega game in the home. But although, albeit I didn't know that it was a Sega game, I'm going to play this shooting game with a plane. I just remember going through all those games, and I remember playing Hang On and Space Harrier as well. But yeah, it was Afterburner that I loaded up first. It was probably just because it was the first disc. It was at the top left-hand corner when I opened it up and just fired that in. Sort of slammed it in, I think, in disgust at the fact that it still wasn't the Mega Drive that I'd asked for and was told I was getting. You know what I mean? But hey, that's up with me. It was Afterburner. And as I say, I had no idea at all that it was a Sega franchise. I can't even remember if Sega were the ones who ported it or whether it was...
I imagine it was US Gold or someone.
That name was going to come up, US Gold.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, because I know it's in the Amiga, and you just mentioned it just now that it was in your big sleeve, but the copy of Outrun, did it have that intro in it that I know it's in the US Gold presents dun 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 Outrun? Please tell me I had that.
I can't remember offhand, but I wouldn't be surprised, because US Gold's marketing, and you know, even on if you did buy any original games, the logo was like the biggest logo on the front, and they just had to have a loading screen with a big, pretentious, stupid gold emblazoned, stupid angled at the corners logo. It probably was them that done it. But I can't remember if that intro was it. I may have to go on YouTube now and look up a playthrough and see if someone, I bet it's a pure bad, like a really bad port as well. Like, and in my mind, I can see the gameplay and go, it's Afterburner. But I bet any money, if you were to actually look at it on YouTube or something, it would be utterly hellish.
What are your memories of that version? Again, we know that the port probably wasn't the best at the time, but I mean, sometimes when that's, and again, we'll talk about this when we talk about the first game I played, which is sounding eerily similar to yours. I didn't think my game was that bad. Obviously, hindsight, I know it's objectively not the best now, but what do you remember what your feelings were at the time?
It was a kind of a double-edged sword, really, because obviously coming for the Spectrum, it was a massive step up. You know, in terms of visuals and loading times, obviously, like you weren't sitting waiting 20 minutes for this to load. There was also more colours. The game was faster. I mean, again, this is all just kind of thinking back. I was grudgingly impressed with it. It wasn't the machine that I wanted. It wasn't the games that I wanted. But at the same time, I was appreciating that, well, this is better than what I had. I had this big pack of games there. There was plenty of stuff in it. And that port of Afterburner, I do remember playing it, just thinking, it was fun, it was enjoyable enough. But again, I've not laid eyes on the port for many, many years, so how it holds up now, I have no idea. But it was at that time, at that age, given that I'd spent, you know, for a few years on the Spectrum, it was good fun. It was loaded faster, looked better, ran faster. As a kid at that time, it was a good experience.
Yeah, I imagine so. I mean, you were playing on an ST for a start. You weren't playing, I mean, because it got Afterburner got ports by US Gold to absolutely everything. you weren't playing the Spectrum version or the you know, CPC version or anything like that. And I know I do watch a few of the console port comparison videos, and I think sometimes the Amiga and ST ports, the frame rates aren't great, and they do have a few issues, but they look nice. And I think when your only frame of reference is maybe if you had a very quick 50p go or quid go, however much it was on the Afterburner arcade machine, you go back home and you're going to have that disconnect, and you get back on it and it's probably close enough, especially when you're on a 16-bit home computer like you were. I can imagine it was okay at the time. I'd imagine you'd had a fair bit of fun with it.
Aye, I see it. It was going up from a spectrum. It was a massive leap up, but I definitely need to go back and watch a YouTube video, mate, for a playthrough and see how the mind's eye lines up to the reality.
Yeah, after this, first thing I'm going to do is just check out Battle of the Ports on YouTube. Retrocore and see what he says. I mean, he doesn't hold back.
Oh, mate, I've just loaded it up. Oh, mate, that's bad. Oh, Jesus, look at those weapon effects. It's like somebody, the plane's just shat out snow. What is happening here, man? It's literally running at like 5 frames a second. Just to imagine John having a field day with this on Digital Foundry.
Oh, dear. Yeah. I can't imagine those guys getting hold of it. And
get Alex Battaglio on. Oh, Jesus. Oh, that's so bad. No, thank you.
Yeah. Better off playing it on the old Sega Ages collection. Eh?
Yes, 100%.
Oh, dear. All right, so mine then is, as I said, eerily familiar to your own. So my first gaming system was a trusty Commodore 64. I remember I first of all got a cartridge with it, but I didn't get a cassette deck until a few weeks later.
Rich kids with your Commodore cartridges.
I only had two.
I had a mate at school with a Commodore 64 with a cartridge and he had Total Recall. That was it.
Yeah, I had the cart that came with it. It was like a 4-in-1 cart, and I had Chase HQ2 or Special Criminal Investigation, which I got. And then I had a couple of tapes, and I needed to get the tape deck with it. My dad would occasionally bring some games home from like work or the pub. People would give him games to give to me. A lot of the time, it was like Memorex C90 tapes that hardly ever worked. But this one, I remember we being given a big box, and inside was three cassettes, and it's called Giants, and it was a banging compilation actually. So it had a few on there, not all Sega games. The only Sega game on there was a little game called Outrun, and I. You know, I played a few. I remember playing Gauntlet 2 a lot with my brother. But then the only other game I remember playing a lot is Outrun. And I loved it. At the time, I loved it. I thought it was really hard. I couldn't get past the first stage for absolutely ages. But I remember loving the music. I remember, you know, loving the fact that you were driving a Ferrari in this, you know... It's hard to imagine. Like, this was my first experience with Outrun. So bear in mind what Outrun looks like in the arcade. I didn't have that frame of reference. All I had was Commodore 64 Outrun. And straight away, I can remember myself thinking this game looks really pretty. I'm driving through this tropical paradise, you know, where Outrun starts. If you look at the Commodore 64 version now, and I think everyone knows what I'm going to say about the Commodore 64's color palette, and it ain't tropical.
No. There's a lot of brown in there. You're driving through mud.
It's like driving a cigarette. It's like driving a Ferrari through the desert course, mate. I loved it. I didn't know that Outrun was made by Sega, and I've got my Commodore 64 from my parents a lot earlier this year, and got it set up, you know, the rest of my gaming stuff in my little games corner. And I actually fancy playing that very specific version of Outrun. You know what? I don't think it's not terrible. It's certainly not the best version of the game. But and I was thinking, well, you know, at the time I didn't put two and two together. I didn't realize this was made by Sega. But when I loaded the game up, and after I was hit with the fit inducing flashing multicolored lines of the loading screen, I realized why. And if you look at the title screen, it's got the big Outrun logo, and then in the bottom left it's got this giant US Gold logo, and in the bottom right, it's got this massive logo that says developed by whoever. And in a tiny little footnote at the bottom, it's got copyright Sega.
Just the people that made the game barely getting mentioned.
That's the only place you see it. It's tiny. It's like in the smallest font that you could possibly manage on a Commodore 64. And you don't see Sega's name anywhere else. It's just amazing. I'd imagine some of the ST ports that you played were a little bit like that.
Yeah. I mean, US Gold was synonymous. I mean, the other one, the infamous one as well, was the Street Fighter 2 port.
Oh, God, yeah.
They're all over that as well. I think Mercs was done by them, possibly, that comes to mind. Trying out other games, but they were UN Squadron was another US Gold, I remember, on the ST and the Amiga.
So I heard that that's actually a really good port.
It's not bad. That does run well. Thinking back to that was really fast. That was good fun. UN Squadron was really good fun, but they were so synonymous with arcade ports on the home computers. They were absolutely everywhere.
A lot of it is, I think, back in the day that they didn't have the arcade code to work with. They would literally get to play the arcade game and then go back to the office and code it there from memory.
Take a shot and remember it and then go back to the office and try and rebuild it.
But why does the road go at the end of this? Is it left? Yeah, fuck it.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, you've only got 6 weeks to code this, then we've got to ship it.
Aye. When did Street Fighter 2 get made in? 3 days?
Yeah.
So bad.
Is the Commodore 64 port of Street Fighter 2 got made in like a week or something? By one what guy?
The hell? One seriously?
Guy. It's just like, I think there's a, yeah.
Dude, that's what you call crunch, mate. That's what you call crunch.
You modern developers don't know how good you've got. You don't know you're born.
That poor guy sitting there, rocking back and forth in his chair, listening to the Bungie, the 343 guys, talking about they got a year's extension to make their game. Lucky sods.
I had a week to make my game.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting, though, that we both first got introduced to Sega games via home computers, both by US Gold, and both iconic superscalers. And I think we touched on this before, didn't we, that Sega is, I think it was in a previous episode, we were saying that Sega are, you know, this, it's driving around in your Ferrari or in your F-15 Tomcat or whatever it is. It's just that, you know, Sega was the sports car of arcade games of that era. I'm sure we said that before. It's just funny that both of our experiences line up like that.
Aye. I mean, there's so many kind of things, and it is strange that, you know, given the fact that, you know, we're from opposite ends of the country and, you know, a couple of years age difference as well, and I've only ever spoken through the power of internet, that obviously we've got such similar experiences, not just in the kind of first Sega games, but so many kind of other experiences that we've spoken about as well, you know, like the witnessing the retail bias that went against the Saturn when it came to the PlayStation, you know, just all these wee things. And again, maybe that can fall into the whole kind of raised by Sega thing, that the fact that you can have people from all over who, for whatever reason, just have got these so eerily similar shared experiences, you know, that just the way that they experienced the Sega games, where they experienced them, how they followed Sega, the kind of the mindset and the outlook they have and had on Sega growing up, and obviously that kind of, we're almost kind of, it's like quite protective as well. And I think, I don't know if that's something that maybe older Sega fans have got, and I don't know if it's maybe because of kind of, obviously, we were both in home computers, and then you managed to get onto the kind of console, you know, product line before I did, one generation before. But, you know, just if you think about it, just that whole kind of, because you were raised by them, and that kind of, they were such a part of, as we've spoken about, key life events like birthdays and Christmases, and they were always there. And, you know, you're forming your opinions of not just games, but life in general as you go through your kind of teenage years, you know. So Sega were always in the background of that. They were giving us those gaming experiences that were kind of formulative, and in the background, whatever was happening in our life, it was Sega we fell back on to be entertained. You know, we've laughed, cried, you know, I mean, certainly, you know, some parts of the orchestral score of Shenmue, man, that can still bring a lump to my throat. Just it's so such a beautiful bit of music. And again, there's no other company that can do that. I mean, Halo's music's beautiful, Gears of War's music is stunning, but I mean, people are going, you're not a real gamer if you didn't cry when Dom died. And I just wanted to skip the cutscene, mate, to be honest with you, but I was like, you know. So I just think it's, we are quite kind of protective, I think, and I think a lot of that can be seen sometimes on Twitter as well with you and I, where as we see it more and more that, you know, there is that kind of attempt to kind of rewrite the narrative a wee bit by the bigger companies who are more prevalent now, and Sega seem quite content to just kind of sit back and let things be said. But I think the kind of older fans do have that kind of protective nature of the company, and I think we're a bit more respectful of the heritage. And again, I think that just all comes back to the fact that they had such a profound impact on us as we did become, you know, men. We grew from boys to men. They were always there giving us entertainment and fun, whatever was happening in our lives at that time.
Yeah, spot on, mate. Yeah, I think that is it. It's almost like their family, isn't it? You know,
hi. It's your Uncle Sega.
Yeah, I was thinking like Fast and the Furious, the Dom. You know, John's like, yeah. I don't need this. I got my family, and that's Sega. Driving a car through an airplane or something.
I don't have friends. I've got family. Yeah,
yes, that's the one. I'm just going to say, going back to your point just then about the PlayStation bias and retail, I saw a tweet earlier today. Someone was replying to a PlayStation thing, and they said one of my worst jobs was being employed by PlayStation marketing, and that my job was to go around the country rearranging store shelves so the PlayStation games were at the front.
Oh, mate, I've seen one of the guys. Honestly, swear to God, it was in Comet and Partick. It was like, they did, literally, and I thought the guy, unless he did work in the actual shop, but he was literally moving the cases, and you see them kind of rearranging the PlayStation cases and bringing them at the front, make sure they were looking at, you could see them measuring the displays and all that to make sure how much shelf space they were getting. I mean, you saying that, I've seen people doing that.
I've got to explore it one day, mate. I think we'll go a deep dive into that sort of retail bias. I mean, we could go into that right now for ages.
Jeez, that's quite interesting. I mean, I've seen people doing that back then, literally pulling PlayStation cases to the front of shelves.
Yeah, every little tactic, mate. But we'll come to that. But back to what you were saying, I think a lot of people do get quite protective of Sega, and I think it is that. I'd imagine a few of our listeners as well do have very similar backgrounds, especially those of us, you know, in Europe and in the UK, where Nintendo really wasn't a thing. They weren't an event. You know, you started off with a Speccy. I started off with a Commodore 64, and I think most people our age started off with home computers of that nature, and probably played their first Sega games, possibly via the same multi packs that we did, similar multi packs, and even, you know, maybe if they were a bit more aware of the arcade scene and went out and bought ports of those Sega games. I mean, Sega was prominent, and where Nintendo was almost a non-event over here in the UK and in Europe, I think Sega were the ones that became a household name outside of the home computer like market leaders.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a wee question also. You've mentioned as well that you'd played that Afterburner, right? That mad machine. Right, you've played that, but we've talked about what the first Sega game we played in the home was, and we didn't even know there were Sega games, right? Can you remember, because I can remember mine, that's why I just thought it there, can you remember the first time you seen and played a Sega arcade game?
Yes. Well, I don't think it's the first time. I think I must have played a few before, as I've got a lot of memories of being in arcades when I was very young. But I do remember that Afterburner arcade cab is one of my very earliest memories. And it was in a I'm sure it was in an arcade down in some coastal town. I remember because I remember I was playing Chase HQ. So that's what my earliest gaming memory, and I was rubbish at it. And I remember my dad took over and beat one level and then let me watch me get creamed on the next. But then I played there the Afterburner cab afterwards. And, you know, at the time, I didn't last long at all. You know, I think I was really young. We were talking age 6 or something. And yeah, I got absolutely plastered in Afterburner. And I think the machine, even for the time, you know, it may have been only 50p ago, but I think everything around it would have been a lot less. We're probably talking 10 or 20p ago for everything else. So I didn't get another go on it. But yeah, that's very fleeting. That was probably my earliest Sega arcade game memory. But what would yours be, mate?
Well, in true greedy Glaswegian fashion, my first experience of a Sega arcade game came in a chippy. And the game was Power Drift.
Oh, very nice. We had arcade machines in chippies and arcade machines in cab stations, but we never had Sega ones. And Power Drift, that's a good one, mate.
It was a stand-up Power Drift cabinet in the corner of the Blue Lagoon. What a name for a chippy, the Blue Lagoon. Get your greasy chips at the Blue Lagoon. But it was in there. And it was always used to pass it on the way back to Queen Street Station on a Saturday. This is like kind of, again, when I was a lot younger before we started hitting the actual arcades and seeing Virtua Fighter my many years on. But I Power Drift. And I always remember it was replaced by WrestleFest.
Oh.
So there we go. It was that this chippy. It was on the corner. I can't mind the street. I can see where it is. I just can't remember the name of the street. And it was right on the corner. And obviously right in the kind of where the glass windows were, right in that corner, they had it was Power Drift standing in there. It was a stand-up cabinet. And I just remember, you know, for a bag of chips, my uncle went for a bag of chips. And while he was getting served, I was watching this mental racing game. And I think it was similar, 50p ago or something. And I was like, the chips are just in, mate. They'll be ready. I got the usual chippy part. Chips are just in, mate. It'll be 5 minutes. And I was like, I can have a shot of this and 50p. And frick, didn't even get anywhere near finishing the first. It was, you know, yourself with Power Drift, man. It's like up and down. It's like crazy, crazy speed and camera angles that you're involved in. And my reflexes at that time for something that fast were just never going to cope. It was like
at that ejecting time. I can't play it now, mate.
Too many colours in him. I'm not that great myself, but injecting all these colours into my eyeballs at that point. So Power Drift, I always remember that. That was the first Sega arcade game I seen was Power Drift. And then months later, it was replaced. Just one random Saturday walked past and it was WrestleFest that was there. So there you go. That's my one, Power Drift.
Bit of a downgrade for old WrestleFest.
I know. It wasn't a bad game, WrestleFest, right enough. It wasn't too bad.
Yeah, not too bad. Decent Mega Drive port as well. But after Power Drift, you know, you'd think that you'd want something, you'd want more, wouldn't you?
It's a wee bit slow.
So you've done first games and first arcade games. I think first console, I think we'll touch on that. And I know people have heard our tales of our first consoles probably a few times, but just probably a recap. I mean, your first Sega console that you owned was not the home console, was it?
No, it wasn't. No, it was a portable. As we've talked about before, obviously having the Sega Game Gear that I inherited from my uncle, the Game Gear that inspired many trips to what everyone wants. for the budget shelf, I mean, picking up Alien 3, The Terminator, Prince of Persia, Wolf Child, Kickoff, Mortal Kombat 1, Robocop versus The Terminator. I mean, some bloody good games there. And 8-bit versions weren't too bad. Sonic Spinball, obviously Sonic 1 and 2. And of course, I watched the World Cup final in 1994 on a Sega Game Gear. There you go. But my first one there, and I was fully aware it was a Sega console, although, again, I had to go through the pain of enduring an Atari console before I would finally get it, because as I've spoken about in the show in the previous episodes, and not to bore people with repeating the same story, but yeah, my uncle would take him out and had to try to gauge opinion by having me standing in front of the tripod in Tandy with the Game Boy, the Game Gear and the Lynx. And for some reason, despite me standing there with almost a neon arrow pointing at the Game Gear, they still bought me a Lynx with the Batman Returns pack. So it was a wee bit after that I would inherit his Game Gear off him. But it was great to just finally have that kind of wee bit of Sega magic and actually an actual machine with Sega branding on it and Sega games. But as good as it was, it still felt watered down, and obviously I wouldn't get the full fat experience until the Sega Saturn.
Oh, and we'll come on to the Saturn in a second. I know it's funny that you mentioned that the Game Gear was watered down, and I guess it was to a degree. I mean, I didn't have a Sega console to call my own until the Sega Saturn. I was sharing and watching from afar for the most point. Well, I know, I think we've touched on my story before, but I think it's my sister and it had a Game Gear, and I think much as I was envious of her having a Game Gear and trying to steal a go on it, I'd be the same be the same with yours. Looking, and I'd seen people with Game Boys at the time, and that I felt like the Game Gear was such a step up. But I think it's not a bad one to start with, mate. The first full color games console. And that was pretty much unrivaled spec-wise until the Game Boy Advance in 2001. So it's a good way to start.
Could have been worse, eh?
Yeah. I mean, my Sega history is, and I don't know, I've touched on this, and I've got a blog post on there on the Sega Guys WordPress site. But my first experience of a Sega console was actually my little brother's. And he wanted, well, remember when, I don't know if it was the same for you, mate, every gaming device was computers. When I was growing up, my brother would be like, I want a computer for my birthday. Everything was a computer. We'd buy Sonny a computer. So we bought him a Master System because it was a computer. Aye. I don't know if it was the same for you.
It wasn't video games they were called. It was, can I buy a computer game?
Yeah.
It's like, you were just, and even now, like my wife would tell me, she'll say to me, is that you buying me our computer games?
Mine's the same. Sitting there playing those bloody computer games again.
That almost sounds like the intro of a Jet Set Radio. I can't get to sleep.
You stop playing with those computer games of yours.
Play with that. Dance at the dee 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 dee.
Oh, yep. We got to do a Sega Guys remix.
The EV Rate and intro.
That's our new intro for our third season, mate.
April 2022.
He wanted a computer because his big brother had a Commodore 64, so he wanted a computer. Because I was a horrible shit when I was. Oh, sorry, we're on in the afternoon in Radio Sega. I was not a nice big brother. I kind of hogged it. I hogged the Commodore 64. I let him play like Gauntlet with me on some games, but a lot of the time I was hogging it for myself. So he wanted his own one naturally, and he got the Sega Master System 2. For his birthday, and he got Sonic the Hedgehog, he got Space Harrier, he got Mickey Mouse Castle Illusion, a few others, the Ninja, Alex Kidd was built in, and I was just, I went from, it's not a proper computer, to, oh my God, this is the best thing ever, and I think it was instantly, I loved games at that point. I loved my Commodore 64, but from the moment that we played Sonic the Hedgehog on the Master System, it just turned into a full-blown obsession. A Space Harrier, I think Space Harrier was like, because the Master System is a great port considering the hardware, and the sprites are massive and so clean. And I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then Sonic went in and that was it. That was it. I might as well just throw the Commodore out the window at that point. Of course, as much as I didn't let him play the Commodore 64, I was stealing a go on his Master System every chance I got. Oh, dear. But yeah, I became obsessed with Sonic the Hedgehog, and then that was me begging my mum and dad in 1992 for a Mega Drive, which was far too expensive for any single present. So I strong-armed my brother and sister into asking for a Mega Drive as well so that we could get one to share between us. So the Mega Drive is kind of my first Sega console, in that although I had to share it three ways. And it wouldn't be until the Saturn that I'd finally have a Sega console to call my own.
Yep, pretty much exactly the same. And again, my kind of Saturn ownership is kind of in two bits, which is quite strange. Because obviously, on launch day, and again, not going to revisit old ground, but obviously on that launch day, my uncle had picked up the Saturn and surprised me when I visited, seen Virtua Fighter in the home for the first time, getting to play it on weekend visits up to see him and stuff like that, seeing Panzer Dragoon and getting to play Sega Rally and VF2, you know, when they were new was wonderful. But it was obviously Christmas 96 was when I got finally a Sega that was bought for me, that was in my bedroom, that only I had access to and was playing. And that bundle that I got, it was from the Dixons. And it was VF2, Sega Rally, Euro 96, and was it Thunderhawk 2, Firestorm?
Yeah, that's a great game.
So that was my four that I got there. And I just had a nice Mark 1 Saturn with those four games, and I still remember, even though I'd been playing one like since launch day and I had access to it in the weekends and stuff like that, but still opening that up on Christmas morning and still remember that morning vividly. It was still, even just ripping the paper back and seeing the black box with the blue, lovely blue S, the kind of the ring, the Saturn ring around the big silver globe, and just that kind of the wee screenshots that made up the rings of Saturn, getting around the logo and the console. Oh, superb. And then taking it through, and I remember I had in the corner of my room, I still for some reason, even though obviously I had the ST in that, but I'd kind of my computer desk, always computer desks, didn't we? For some reason, you had your telly in the top bit, and then you had your bit with your computer, then you had a stupid wee drawer that slid out underneath for your keyboard, your mouse. You felt like a tit because you ended up having to pull it out, and then it hit your gut, and you had to sit away back, and you were stretching away forward, and for Christ's sake. Bloody monstrosities. But I had my computer desk, and I literally, had that. It was my Amiga I had it at that point, and I was just disconnected and tossed. I was like, get off of there. and the Saturn gets set up, and it was like, oh, where have you been? This is what I wanted, this sleek little black box with a controller with more than one button to do stuff. And I just sitting there playing those games and just absolutely in awe that finally I had a Sega to call my own.
What was the first game you put on, mate? Do you remember?
Oh, VF2.
Yeah, I think it's very similar again. Yep. to me. So
yeah,
that was the first game I threw on. Because I bought mine home on my, I can't remember if it was actually on my birthday day or the day after my birthday. My birthday is in November, and I'd been saving up. I had a paper round, which I think we've covered on the before. You know, 12 quid a week. I think we said about buying a mega CD. It would last us all the way up to 2021 to get one. Then, but yeah, I think I started saving for a 32X. and then at the end of 1995, it was Sega Saturn. I was still saving, and then I used my money I'd save from that and my birthday money to buy a Sega Saturn. And similar to you, mate, I was just in love with the box. It's one of these things as well, and I don't know if you put the two boxes side by side. You had the like black and blue Sega Saturn box, which was so ornate and stylized with the, as you said, those screenshots going around the S, depicting all these games and the bright colors. And then by comparison, you had this ugly gray and black at the front, yellow on the sides, and then just rectangles of games at the back with the PlayStation box side by side. It will always baffle me, but yeah. And I remember picking it up with, you know, my birthday money and money from my paper round I'd been saving up in November, and just going into Comet at the time and trying to buy a Saturn. And a guy was saying to me, "You need to buy a PlayStation." I was like, no, I'm getting a Saturn. And even my mum was questioning it. Are you sure you don't want a PlayStation? Yes, I'm sure I don't want a PlayStation.
You can save £100. No, you can't, because you don't get a game and you don't get a memory card. So there's at least 70 quid straight away, your 100 quid that you saved.
Exactly. And the thing was, I played Destruction Derby in early in 1995, you know, when it wouldn't have been early 95, it would have been late 95. Played it in Watford Harlequin, and I remember thinking, oh, Destruction Derby seems pretty cool, but the gamepad, why is the D-pad four separate buttons? Why isn't it all together? why is there only four face buttons? Why have they got two shoulder buttons? This is nonsense. I can't play with this. If this is a first party controller, it feels like a third party SNES pad. No. Yep. Sega Saturn looks like a Mega Drive 6 button controller. Thank you very much. Feel right at home here. So my mind was made up despite what the man in Comet said. Yeah, got home, went to take it upstairs, unwrapped it all, you know, took out the box, wondered what this giant plug at the end of the TV lead was, and completely bemused by it and the lack of an RF cable, which meant that I had to kick mum and dad off the telly downstairs and play on the and I think I've mentioned this again, so apologies if we're treading old ground, but we rented our you know, quotation marks, widescreen TV from Rumbelows at the time.
Yep.
And that had a SCART adapter in, so plugged it in that, and yeah, first game I put in was Virtua Fighter 2. And I was blown away. I've not been as blown away by anything. Closest is probably the Dreamcast playing Sonic Adventure 2 and Sega Rally 2. But nothing else has come close to being blown away by playing Virtua Fighter 2 via RGB SCART on that sort of telly. The jump from playing a Mega Drive was astronomical. And imagine, you know, as you said, you pulled the Amiga out, tossed that to the side, gave drop kick to it. I'd imagine it felt the same to you sticking Virtua Fighter 2 on.
Aye. I mean, I'd played it on my uncle's, because, as I said before, I'd kind of managed to somehow get him to buy Sega Rally and Virtua Fighter 2 within a week of each other and beat. And I can't remember what one he bought first, but what one came out first, it doesn't matter, but I remember sitting at the train station and I'm looking at the back of the box and he's like,
"How are you doing? Did I not buy you a game last week as well?"
And I'm like, yes uncle, you did. And I didn't mention that when you were at the cash desk in Beatties, because I knew it. But I mean, obviously having that copy that was your own, you know, and with the Virtua Fighter 2 disc is beautiful, that blue disc with the silhouettes of the fighters across it, amazing, just booting up your own Saturn and knowing that this was my copy. And of course those lovely Saturn cases, which obviously as the years have gone by, time hasn't been kind to some of them and the glue's worn off and they don't, you know, seal shut properly and that kind of thing. But at that time, the cardboard was nice and new, and I just loved those cases. It was just a complete transformation to have, you know, these beautiful bespoke, you know, video game cases as opposed to having, you know, piled high floppy disk holders, you know, because obviously the amount of boxed games I had for the Amiga was nothing compared to the amount of pirated games I had. So my Amiga collection was like something out of like a school classroom for computing. It was just those horrible beige, long, stupid disc holder boxes with a plastic lid, and they had a wee key. Do you remember them?
I think I saw one once, but I didn't see enough because I didn't own one myself, but I know of them.
I remember for my birthday one year, right? I kid you not, I unwrapped this and it was one, because they were singles, right? So they were the width of a floppy disk, right? I remember opening up a case, it was the width of three. You can now put all your discs in one case. I'm like, ooh, hold me back. Fucking kind of presents that to give you, boy, man, honestly. Here's your floppy disk holder. Right, brilliant. Cheers, I can now amalgamate all of them into one box. Super. With a wee stupid key. What do you need to lock your discs for? They're going to steal Amiga discs.
Well, people can copy them easily enough. Oh, dear.
Well, it's like, I'm just... You going to school? I mind to lock the discs before you go. What?
Oh God! It's funny you mentioned the cases though, and I think that to me is another thing being raised by Sega, and maybe the Game Gear is a bit of an outlier in this respect because that had the cardboard cases, but I had the Commodore 64. And that had, you know, your cardboard boxes that were basically cassette tapes, or you had your plastic C90 or cassette tape cases, very standard stuff. And imagine Amiga, you had your cardboard box the same. But Sega always had very bespoke hard cases for their main consoles. One of the first things I remember about the Master System was having these plastic boxes that snapped open. I mean, Nintendo always had their cardboard cases as well. So Sega were, pretty much forging ahead in terms of sustainable game storage was concerned. Of course, those snap open plastic boxes carried on with the Mega Drive. And you're talking about those, the Virtua Fighter 2 disc. I mean, how good was that case? How good was the artwork on there? I know the US Saturn artwork and game cases get a bit of stick, and I think they deserve to. But I think the PAL stuff, even though the plastic cases and the cardboard on them feel a bit flimsy, the artwork and the visual aspect of it and the design and the aesthetic was so well done. And even though they were only so thick because they were in about 30 different languages because they were the PAL version. But the manuals, mate, especially that Virtua Fighter 2 one, it felt like he had a book with it, didn't he?
I VF2, when he was like, you need two hands to pick it up, man. It was a hefty box, man. But I mean, even Sega Rally's disc as well, it was black with the green and red, the kind of Castro for the Toyota, for the Celica. Again, it had the logo in full colour, and then it had the kind of green and red dashes as well. It was just just so much attention to detail and just blowing memories.
Yeah, just the whole aesthetic of the Saturn just really struck a chord with me. I absolutely adore it. So yeah, I think very similar. We both put on Virtua Fighter 2 first, and both had those feelings about the boxes and everything else, and I think that's all very much part of being raised by Sega. I mean, I still remember my first Christmas with the Saturn as well. I'd played Virtua Cop 2 in the arcade in the summer, and that was one of the other driving reasons why I wanted a Sega Saturn, because I knew it was getting a port, and of course it did get one. I think it came to the Saturn, I think it came in December 96, and that was the number one thing on my Christmas wish list. Obviously, I only had Daytona, Sega Rally, and Virtua Fighter 2 at the game. You know, amazing games, and that would have done me for a while, but I wanted Virtua Cop 2 as well. And my mum never let me forget it, because it was Christmas Day, and I could not tell you anything else I got that morning. I got Virtua Cop 2, so I ran straight upstairs, ran out, plugged it all in, started playing it. My brother, I don't know whether this was him trying to muscle in or whatever, but he got Sega Worldwide Soccer, even though it wasn't his console.
Oh, yeah.
He got a lot of playtime out of that, so he got his shit. I think it was revenge for what I did with his Master System. But yeah, I went up and put Virtua Cop 2 on. And my uncle came round Christmas morning with Christmas presents for us all. Decent ones as well. And I think he gave me this, I can't remember, it was a polo shirt by a brand name. So it wouldn't have been cheap. And I was in the middle of playing Virtua Cop and just teenager, you know, I think I would have been 13 at the time, just completely involved in that Virtua Cop, paused it, ripped it open. Oh, thanks. Tossed it to the side and carried on playing Virtua Cop. I'm all like, couldn't believe how rude you were tossing the game. That's how involved in it was.
See, whenever you were that age, right, and every boy, right, will admit to this, soft presents were shit. Right?
Yep.
If it didn't come in a box, it wasn't getting opened. I mean, I specifically remember Christmas mornings where, like, either my parents or my uncle and my grand would nudge the soft gifts back towards me that I had tossed aside to get to them. I could see boxes. Boxes are toys. And the thing as well, there was a shop, as we got on our tangent, a shop in Glasgow, right, called The Sweater Shop, right, and that's all it sold was sweaters, as the name suggests, right? But do you know who the face of their company was?
No, go on.
Stephen Hendry. And it was Stephen. Their windows were Stephen Hendry and his missus standing in the hills, roaming in the Globins in a sweater shop. A sweater. And that was a logo. The Sweater Shop. And it was horrible. Like, they made Pringle look like decent, mate, honestly. And again, you knew anything that was soft. It was, at the age of 14, I had a wardrobe full of Sweater Shop sweaters, and they never get touched.
Oh, but my kids like it now. I mean, we're trying to explain. My son's just turned 14, and we try and explain to him, you know, you need clothes, and you know, clothes aren't cheap for you.
No,
and these are really nice clothes that we're trying to get you. But my daughter, she delivered a cracker. She's 10. And she's at that age where she knows. She either is, and I think she's playing that along with it because she thinks that she won't get presents otherwise. But she plays these games with us. So she said to us the other day, I really don't want Santa Claus to bring me any knickers or socks for Christmas. Well, you know, don't you need knickers and socks? Well, how does Santa know that I need knickers or socks? but she said that, and just me and her wife just looked at each other. I was like, I can't answer that. How does Santa Claus know I need new knickers? You know,
Jesus Christ, I've got this to look forward to.
Yeah,
mine's only three, and I'm already getting it in the neck.
Yeah, it's 14, 7, and 10, my three are. And yeah.
How do you still have hair?
Oh, mate, it's diminishing rapidly. But they're all the same. They all hate soft presents. Much as I suppose we did back in the day.
That's it. Just kids, they want toys, they want cool stuff. They don't want clothes. And then they get to a certain age where all they seem to want is clothes. You know, it's got to be the labels here and, oh, God. Yeah. There's only one label we cared about, mate. Yeah. The Sega label.
The Sega label. Well, I suppose the next chapter then, you know, we both had that amazing, but it sounds like we both had amazing Sega Saturn Christmases. And, both loved our consoles. As I think it's well documented that the Sega guys love the Sega Saturn to absolute bits, and it's both of our favourite console. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about how underrated it was. I mean, as I say, I'm listening to some of the comic, the podcast, and reading the comic at the moment. And what's apparent to me is it got to 19. It's the end. We're at the end of 1995 now, and they haven't even mentioned the Sega Saturn. It just goes to show how much Sega weren't promoting it and work behind it. I mean, we talk about how much it wasn't promoted in the US, but it just seems to be that it was something in Europe as well, which was a real shame.
Aye, that was just, I mean, I think I did a fair amount of promotion for Sega in school when it came to the Saturn, because as I said before, I smuggled the Saturn instruction manual out of my uncle's house because I just wanted to prove that I had access to it. And I just remember getting out of school and pulling out this instruction manual because I was, my uncle's got a Sega Saturn. I don't believe you. It's just came out. It's 400 quid. Nobody's got that. Oh, yeah. I pulled out the manual. And it was crazy, like, the buzz around seeing the manual for a Saturn. It was like people were genuinely interested. This is a manual. To turn the console on, press the power button. That's amazing. It's like, how do you do this?
Extended play can lead to seizures.
Amazing. What's a seizure?
But I think in those first few months of that first year from the Saturn's launch, there was something mythical about it, wasn't there? Because it was just so, Sega weren't promoting it enough, and it was so expensive that I don't think any kid could get one at launch. It was this, you know, you'd had the 32X, 32X until, you know, through Christmas and into the new year, and then all of a sudden the Saturn's there, and it was just... Yeah, it was just like this mythical beast. I think it still retains a lot of that exoticness, as I've mentioned before, that allure of being something, you know, almost just like a rare artifact. You know, that Indiana Jones moment where he's got the sack of sand in one hand and looking at a sack of Saturn on the curry store shelf in the other.
I remember the advert. I remember seeing the advert, but it was long after I'd first played one, obviously, and my uncle picked it up, and it was also the one whenever the guy's eyeballs get sucked through the tubes and he's playing Daytona, and the wee guy that's in the car is just like a kind of passenger for the game, and he's playing the, you know, it's like, does he design the games? No, he executes them. And then you hear Lau kicking the dung out or something in the background, and then Panzer Dragoons on the screen and all that kind of stuff. But I remember seeing that advert, but it wasn't like constant. I think that must have just been by complete fluke chance that I managed to see that on TV. But I mean, it was way after. It's been lamented many times and spoken about, you know, Sega should have delayed the launch 3 months instead of bringing it forward 3 months. I don't know how anybody, I mean, you've got to think as well, what Tom spoke about, and we chatted with him as well about the fact that there was no software ready for it, and he tried to get them to at least stick to the original date, and just obviously his relations with Sega Japan were getting kind of strained at that time as well. But how could nobody at Sega Japan have looked and went, we've got Virtua Fighter 2, Sega Rally and Virtua Cop coming out at the end of the year. Why don't we just wait until the Christmas period and just launch it in the West with those games instead?
Yeah.
Nah. Just launch it early. Why?
Yeah. I think it's one of those things that we were talking about at the beginning where Sega are adventurous and, you know, daring, and sometimes to their detriment. Let's do a surprise launch and launch it early. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, I guess. I suppose if you're being pragmatic about it. It's just one of those things that being quintessentially Sega means being adventurous and daring, but also a little stupid. And I think that probably still applies today.
Either stupid or arrogantly naive. Again, especially from a Sega of Japan perspective, that they looked at the Saturn, they looked at Virtua Fighter, Daytona, and thought, there's nothing like that out over there. They're fine. Get it released. You know, look at what's on the market just now. There's nothing like that. Why wait for the sequels? Get the first games out just now, milk those, and then we'll release the sequels. No, didn't work because he didn't tell anybody until E3. He let poor Tom stand up there, visibly annoyed. We've spoken before on this as well about the comparisons that if you look at the videos of Tom Kalinske talking about, you know, Sonic Tuesday, the enthusiasm, the energy, the positivity, the smile on his face, he's just completely beaming. you know, bragging about, you know, how much they've sold and the market share. And then you look at that E3, whenever he tells people that the Saturn's coming out, it's just completely flat because he didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
He was told to. So, it just all adds to the enigma of the Saturn. You know, everything about it, its whole story. And it is good that people are obviously giving it a chance today. But as we've spoken about, there's people who like to kind of use the, crudeness. Some people call it crudeness of the graphics. I call it the uniqueness of the visuals. To some, they may be crude, but I think, you know, that the Saturn's got a very, very unique look. You know, that's the thing. If you look at gaming today, like, you can put a PlayStation, you could grab a screenshot of an upcoming PlayStation game and an upcoming Xbox game, and you could sit them side by side and say to people which is on which platform, and you would be hard pressed to tell, because gaming's become very ubiquitous in terms of its visual style, and it's more art direction. I think that if you look at Halo Infinite, for example, it's got a very stylized look to it. God of War also on the PlayStation side has a very stylized look to it in terms of kind of art direction. But for generic, you look at, if you put Assassin's Creed beside Watch Dogs and one was Xbox and one was PlayStation, you'd be impossible to tell them apart. But you put a screenshot up of a Saturn and a PlayStation game and you can tell straight away which is which. Very stylized, unique visual style that it's got. But I just, great people are giving it a chance, but where were you when we needed you?
Yeah, and again, Sega didn't help themselves with, I mean, the surprise launch might have worked if they had enough consoles to go around and the price wasn't what it was, but
$299.
Yeah. But yeah, Sega Saturn, as I say, both of our favourite console of all time, but Sega didn't have their stuff together at that point. But I think we both thought that they had everything in place for the Sega Dreamcast. It really felt like that at that time, and it definitely is still a darling in most people's eyes today.
I refuse to let it die. I mean, my trials and tribulations recently on Twitter, oh my God. And I just cannot let that machine go. I have to have it in my life. I've got to. It's just that and the Saturn. I would give up every other console and game I own just to keep the Saturn and Dreamcast beside me. They're just machines and games that I need to have access to. And obviously, as people know, both mine are fully modded with ODEs in them. But to enlighten the listeners, basically my not to turn it into a, you know, tomorrow's world or, you know, tech channel stuff, but my GDM has been having periodic resets and freezes and glitches, and it wouldn't run a game for more than, you know, 20 minutes without, you know, bugging out and various troubleshooting. And I was very kindly, you know, boy Frank on Twitter sent me he had a spare Dreamcast that he had botched a DC HDMI install on and burnt off a couple of the legs on the sound chip. So he sent me that and I was able to kind of try various bits and bobs and managed to isolate it down to the Pico PSU power supply. So I've got a new one of them and I've been trying out stock PSUs, and obviously the GDMU ran fine, but then I left it running for 2 hours and I burned out a capacitor on the stock PSU. It overheated, so my best mate sent me another stock PSU, and then obviously I've been running it kind of hourly intervals just to kind of definitely isolate that it was a power supply issue and all that kind of stuff. So, lots of troubleshooting. And I don't think I would go through anywhere near. That's the kind of message I'm trying to get across here, is that the machine still means that much, that I will go through that. I will sit up until this kitchen table until 12:30 with a screwdriver kit and sitting with a spare telly and hooked up to it and trying this and trying that and ruling this out, because the machine means that much. I've got to have it. It's got to still be there whenever I need to fly around the city in Crazy Taxi or avenge Ryu's father's death in Shenmue, or, you know, battle lumps with somebody with a kendo stick in Soul Calibur. I don't think you would go through that level of hassle for a lump of plastic unless it actually meant something. So, the Dreamcast has put me through the absolute ringer in the last few weeks because of these technical issues. But thankfully, I've isolated it and I've fixed it, so the legend will never die.
I was hoping for that, but...
I was building up to it, mate!
But, and obviously we've spoke at in depth about our memories and our affiliation for the Dreamcast and how, you know, that swirl will always be orange with us. And, yeah, well, you've got a nice orange swirl on your unit now, haven't you?
Mate, you sorted me out, honestly. And that was kind of doubled again with the fact that, you know, Frank's console had a controller port board with the orange LED on it. So, obviously I'm using that in there now, and with the shell that you've providing me for the Japanese console, I am finally back to where I was in April 1999. I've got an orange swirl and that lovely, beautiful glass silver reflective piece of plastic above the LED, which apparently, when I put it on Twitter, the amount of people that have messaged me said, I had no idea about that.
Yeah, well, I said that, didn't I? I said exactly the same thing. I had no idea, and I literally had a Japanese console and a PAL console sat in front of me in my setup, right next to each other. And I've been playing my... these are consoles... the Japanese one I've had since 1999. The PAL ones I've had... If it's not 20 years, it's close to.
It was clearly one of many little kind of... cost-cutting tweaks that I said my uncle got his pal Dreamcast and he was all proud of it. He pulled it out of the box and I looked at it, don't like that swirl colour. And I was like, what's happened to the bit in the lid? What are you talking about? Well, it's a lump of grey plastic. Aye, what is it, yours? Well, mine's a glass effect with a shimmering silver underneath. The Japanese done it properly. it's funny about people that never noticed it, but I noticed it the minute he took his out the box, like, grey lump of plastic.
Clearly got an eye for it, mate. I mean, it's odd.
It's called OCD, mate. That's what just see it like it is.
If I going back to something I said at the beginning of the episode was about how the colour scheme of Sega branding, Sega logo, that blue and white appealed to both of us, maybe because of, you know, what's been drilled into us tribally from a footballing perspective.
It's a dodgy topic you can do, mate, when it comes to football teams in orange, so we'll just move on.
Well, for some reason, we both only affiliate the Dreamcast with the orange swirl, despite all that. So it's funny that the Dreamcast is an outlier in that aspect.
Yeah. Again, I think that comes from the fact that we focused so much on the system from the earliest rumours of it, you know, Katana, Black Belt, New Challenge Conference, that infamous Edge magazine, Sega is dead, long live the Dreamcast, you know, again, importing the consoles, the orange box that they came in. I just think if you were someone who was specifically a PAL gamer and you waited until Dreamcast came out, and you didn't bother dabbling in the Japanese market at all, didn't import, and you maybe only read the odd articles, or, you know, previews and stuff, but it wasn't enough for it to sink in. But I think if you were like us, and you remember Sega Saturn magazine adopting the wee kind of corner icon that was in the corner of the top right-hand corner of Japanese jewel case Dreamcast games, you know, just little kind of things. It just was always there. And then the fact that we imported, and our Dreamcast was Japanese, the swirl was orange. So I think for us, it's just that's the way it always will be. I think if we'd waited and we got PAL consoles first, then we'd be sitting here going about that blue sky swirl. But no, it's Dreamcast is orange. Its colour is orange.
Yeah, I was going to mention that orange box, and no, we're not talking about Half-Life, obviously. We're talking about the orange square in Sega Saturn magazine on the front cover, which was kind of ever present as soon as we came out of the new Challenge Conference. So, yeah, absolutely, mate. We probably won't spend too much time on the Dreamcast, I don't think, because obviously we've got the Dreamcast Memories episode when we were talking about the anniversary of when it was discontinued and our journey through life and death and pre-life when we were, you know, gearing up to pick up the console. which, you know, if any listeners wanted to listen to that, it's on the archive, or probably will catch the archive play on the Radio Sega soon. But obviously, you know, for me, it was almost exactly 10 years from picking up for first playing a Sega console to the discontinuation of the Dreamcast. And obviously both our journeys with Sega and being raised by them from our console and gaming sense ended in 2001. But the dream didn't die with the Dreamcast. Obviously, Sega emerged anew. And although Sega is much changed these days, I think it still plays a heavy part in our gaming taste. And one thing I was going to mention, mate, is obviously you have been the recipient and the purchaser of a couple of Xbox consoles in the last few months. But I think it's probably fair to say that Sega has been a big factor in that.
Yep.
In driving those Xbox purposes, even if one Sega game did kill a console of yours today.
Yes, well, I will enlighten listeners to this one as well. So I bought an unboxed original Xbox from CEX 3 months ago, and on arrival, it wouldn't read discs. It ran Dead or Alive 3 for like 2 minutes and then just died. So returned it. Got my refund and then went, I'll buy a boxed one because if someone's been good enough to keep the box, then they've looked after it. So it was a later revision. It arrived, it was boxed, beautiful condition, not a mark on the case, still had the protective film over the eject and power buttons. The manual was still sealed. The controller still actually, there was no grime or anything. I'm like, this is hardly used. Worked fine. It had been heavily used. Had played a few games on it, and then obviously I'd got a copy of Jet Set Radio Future, which finally last night put it on. Done the first couple of wee basic missions and then met up with Beat, and obviously challenges you to a race. And as I started going round the track with them, not the track, around the streets with them, the music stopped. And all I heard was the Xbox Drive going, oh, for the name of Christ, that's not good. So it's clicking and it's crunching and then ejects the disc. Disc's fine, no problems. Puts in another game, exact same noises, wouldn't load, not a thing. I'm like, oh, for the love of God, another one's broke. But problem being is I've opened the damn thing to take the clock capacitor out, so I can't take it back to CEX because they don't take it back because you've opened the damn thing and the screws are underneath the warranty stickers, so they know you've opened it. So that's that gubbed. So I'm sitting there and I'm going, I need to play Jet Set Radio Future, man. It's never going to come back with compatibility. How can I resurrect this Xbox? Looking about, trying to find replacement DVD drives, there's nothing, because you can put any DVD drive for any Xbox console, any original Xbox console, whether it's Samsung or Hitachi or whatever, they'll all work, they're interchangeable. Couldn't find anything. I'm thinking, right, how can I mod this? How can I soft mod this? Can't do it without a disk drive. Could get a mod chip, because the hard drive's locked. I need to unlock the hard drive, because the hard drive's paired to the motherboard. Damn it. And then I looked on eBay and I found a guy, Cardiff Blues Mark, he's called, and he actually sells fully modified Xbox consoles. So the one I've just purchased today, which goes out by UPS tomorrow, I'm told, is fully modified. It's got new thermal paste on there, fully cleaned out, clock capacitor removed. It's got a Hitachi disk drive in it that works, which is the most sought after because it's most reliable. It's the latest one they put in. 500 gig hard drive, 97 games on there, and the message I sent the guy is Outrun 2, Outrun Coast to Coast, Jet Set Radio Future, Shenmue 2, Panzer Dragoon Order, Toe Jam and Arrow. Are these all on there? Yes, mate, they're all on there. Awesome. And so he's got every game I want that's on there, and it's not because I want to play Halo or Halo 2 or any of the Dead or Alive games are brilliant, you know, I love them as well, but it's the fact that there's Sega games on there that only came to Xbox, are now never going to come to backwards compatibility, as Microsoft have said that that's it now, finally done, nailed down, that's it, you know, nails in the coffin, that's backwards compatibility done. So even though it's not a Sega console, and everybody knows that the Dreamcast kind of provided the lifeblood of Xbox. Its DNA is still coursing through the veins of Xbox as we speak. But again, it's Sega games that are making me, I need to have that thing working. Don't quite have the affinity for it. In fact, I don't have anywhere near the affinity for it that I do for Saturn and Dreamcast. But it's just the fact that those games, I think, to both of us still feel like they should have been and probably would have been Dreamcast games. And in the case of Shenmue 2, it was. But I wouldn't have gone through the hassle of that if there wasn't no Sega games on there, because I'm not going to lie, see, the first time I loaded that disc up and heard Concept of Love, oh my God.
Oh yeah.
Inject that into my veins. So that's my wee Xbox Trials and Tribulations story. Basically, the drives on them, as we've spoken about before, physical, I know collectors love to have their shelves full of, you know, discs and whatnot, but all I will say to you guys is, if you have an ODE solution available, get that drive out of there and play your systems from ODEs or hard drive mods or whatever you can do, and put your disk drives into storage, because when they go, and as we're seeing with the original Xbox, man, there's literally no, you would need to buy another console and basically cannibalize it and take the disk drive out of it. So you're going, well, I'm going to be sitting here with an Xbox, it doesn't work. So the only kind of saving grace I've got is that the case, the actual shell, the console that I've got just now, is immaculate. So if this one comes and it's a wee bit kind of not as nice, and all I need to do is just basically swap the case over, and I can have a nice modded Xbox inside a shiny new case. But aye, it's the downfall of these optical drives, mate. It's just that the media that we love is unfortunately, and again, we've touched on it in the Lost in the Arcade episode, that these, you know, you said the words so eloquently, Sega, please let us give you money to play these games.
Yeah,
give us compilations of these games. Give us other ways for your games to live on. Don't leave your classics prisoners on machines that are aging and prone to breaking down because of just the passing of time, mechanical parts just dying and becoming unavailable. So, aye, there we go. My Xbox story became an impassioned plea to Sega once again to let us just play the damn games.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the thing with Sega, and obviously we're talking about post Sega console now, is that their games are everywhere. But yeah, there's so many that are trapped on the Xbox platform, and even though there is Xbox backwards compatibility, as you said, that's all ending. Not to mention games like Virtua Fighter 4, the versions of that, Shinobi, there's the sequel to Shinobi, its name escapes me right now. So many games that are locked to PlayStation 2. You've got Super Monkey Ball's had remasters, but then things like Billy Hatcher and the Giant Egg, Phantasy Star Online Episode 3 that are on the Nintendo GameCube, and those things are locked to there as well. And it very much is a case of, yeah, Sega, let us give you money to play these games. But Sega have got such a legacy, and it feels like it's such a shame for them to just not fulfill that. I think that's everyone's chief frustration with modern day Sega.
It's a case of they know what they've got sitting there, but they, for whatever reason, and again, it might well come down to licensing, but you know, at the end of the day, for Outrun to come back, just take the Ferrari badge off the back of the car. You know, take the Ferrari branding off and put Outrun 2 and Coast to Coast on modern consoles. You know, I know Outrun SP was on 360, but even that's been removed. If you bought it back in the day, then your digital license is still there and you can re-download it, but you're humped if you didn't get it at the time. Same with Sega Rally 3. Sega Rally 3 Arcade was on 360 as an Xbox Live Arcade game. And it's infinitely better than Sega Rally Revo, as it's known as in the US. It's just Sega Rally here. And again, likewise, but there's so many of their great games and games that you would love to kind of have access to that are, as you say, dotted all over the place. And it would just be great to see them just bring all that together and some kind of compilation. Do what you need to do. I mean, look at Grand Theft Auto. I mean, they face licensing issues all the time. Just take the music out, replace it with something else. You know, it's Crazy Taxi was subject to that, but there was custom soundtracks to put them back in.
Yeah, I think, you know? Well, 50 Cent Blood on the Sand was a game that, I think that soundtrack's been almost completely removed, but that's in Xbox backwards compatibility. But yeah, so hopefully you never know. That's the kind of the near past of Sega. We talked about the distant past, and I suppose where we'll end up now is the future and modern day Sega. And I think for both of us,
the super game
is on its way. And I think for both of us, Sega still drives, you know, some of our purchases. I mean, the Game Pass, I don't think I'd have Game Pass if it wasn't for the Yakuza games. And by extension, I probably wouldn't have my Series X right now if it wasn't for Game Pass. So even dictating my current console status, you can probably lay at Sega's door. And of course, even though, you know, the conversations around the super game being tied to Xbox when it was actually just Sega using Microsoft technology, it's not going to be a Microsoft exclusive, but we do know it's going to come to a Microsoft platform. So yeah, I think that very much is where we are, mate. Wouldn't you agree?
I would be. Oh, mate, no. I've said this on Twitter. No, I would love the super game to be, and it's not going to be, right. And this, they could even do this separately, but I've never mentioned this on the podcast, I don't think, but I've mentioned it on Twitter. How good would it be, right? This is my sales pitch. Everything's cloud-based, right? So there's a lot of stuff about, you know, DLC and app purchases and stuff like that. And obviously, you know, Fortnite's got a lot of this stuff where you can buy bits and bobs and make your characters look unique. And it's a big thing, personalization in gaming, right? I don't personally go and pay any extra for these wee things, but a lot of people do. But could you imagine, right, Cloud Arcade, Sega Cloud Arcade, right? You buy like a base pack, right, and you get maybe Outrun, Space Harrier, Afterburner, you know, Hang On, the basic kind of older games, right? But then you could buy packs where you would have like the Sega Rallies, the Daytonas, the Virtua Cops. You bring out a light gun that works with modern TVs if you want to buy that to play those games. But the arcade's completely customizable, right? So you could basically buy poster pack. So if you wanted to have a section that's Virtua Fighter games, you could put the Virtua Fighter posters on the walls. You could have the wee stands there, cardboard cutouts of the characters, decorate it any way you like. But then using Xbox Live, you could visit your friends' arcades, and no two arcades would ever be the same. So my layout would be different to yours. The games you have would be different to mine. I could come to your arcade and play your games, and could play you and my friends on your arcade games. Likewise, you could come to my arcade and play with your friends on my games. And I just think it would be so amazing if they could do something like that, where you basically get the Sega community to create their own online cloud-based arcade, where you share that with the community and you open it up and let people come in and enjoy it. We've already seen kind of similar things where there was that internet browser based kind of virtual tour of a Sega arcade, and that's what I seen that, and I went, that's the kind of thing. But imagine if you opened that up to actually users and let Sega customers, Sega fans, build their own arcades, spend their money to build the arcade that they always wanted. I could rebuild booths. I could make my own version of Boost. I could put Initial D beside Sega Touring Car. I could put House of the Dead behind it. I could put the F355 cabinet across for it. You know, all these kind of things. I just think it would be such a money spinner. And I think they would just do so well. And I think the Sega community would get really involved in it, because you would have total control, especially if you were a big arcade Sega fan. The idea, for me anyway, of being able to create my own arcade that you could walk through in third person. You could look at the cabinets, walk around the cabinets, the artwork on the sides, a track mode would be running on the screen. You could, I just think it would be absolutely amazing. That's what I think anyway.
Yeah, it would, mate. I think that would be the dream. I can't see it for some reason.
No, no chance.
Yeah. So, but that would be amazing. And I think one thing that would show out is that even though I think we can, so many of us, and especially hopefully those of us on that are our age that are listening to our show on Radio Sega probably can agree with us and envision that sort of thing. And even though we have all been raised by Sega, I think that it's not not controversial to say that all our tastes and games would be different, and something like their own individual arcade would be different for every single person. Mm-hmm. And anyone that wasn't raised by Sega and in that era would really get a taste of what it was like to grow up in that time and be, as we say, raised by Sega, especially that arcade look and feel that they have.
100%, mate.
Cool, mate. I think then, having gone back to the very beginnings, our first Sega games, our first Sega consoles, and talked through all the way to the modern era and even the future with the Super Game, I think it's as good a place to end it as there. But yeah, I think being raised by Sega, it's something that I certainly wouldn't change for the world, it's shaped my gaming tastes today and 30 years in the making. 1991, as I say, my brother got his Sega Master System. 30 years later, it's still the games company, 20 years after they stopped making consoles, that really, you know, is home to me. And I think you feel the same way, do you not, mate?
Oh, totally. Aye, 100%, mate. I couldn't like it anymore.
So we'll throw it back to our listeners. We hope that you've enjoyed listening to us on Winterfest. If you want to reach out to us, let us know, were you raised by Sega? What was your first Sega game, first Sega console? How do you feel about being raised by Sega? Does anything compare? We'd love to hear from you. You can catch me at Swooper_D. You can catch James at The Segaholic. You can catch us both at Sega Guys. Until next time, stay retro and stay Sega.
Winter is coming.
To the king of the north.
in the night. Dreaming delight. I found someone who really cares. In the night. Dreaming delight. I want to see you smile again. In the night.